Spider-Man and Moon Knight. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm the Irredeemable Shag.
Taking you through a classic superhero team-up, Spider-Man and Moon Knight, from Marvel Team-Up number 144, cover dated August of 1984. And Shag, we've had a bunch of two-parters up to now, but this one's one and done.
I was really surprised, because I don't remember what happens in these things. So I had a sneaking suspicion, so I flipped all the way to the end first to cheat to find out for sure. Yeah, so I was surprised. I started thinking about this too. This is our fifth issue we've covered so far in this run.
Right.
And four of them have had different writers. And this is going to be a one and done, and not only in the story, but in the writer too. You know, Kerry Burkett is going to write this and then move on as well. So it's interesting though, and we've said this before, but it still feels sort of a piece. Like if you just erase the writers' names, I don't know that you would know that they're different writers.
Yeah, they're sort of molding themselves to the purpose of the book. I think Spider-Man is so well known. Right?
Yeah.
Anybody can write, I'm not going to say anybody can write Spider-Man well, but, you know, good writers can just write Spider-Man to sound like Spider-Man. His voice is it's unique and it's so well known, so well understood by writers. I think it's hard to make him say or do things that are out of character. Although, we'll see in this issue, there's maybe a weird thing with the powers.
I think we both homed in on that. And it's funny to think that at this point, you know, like Spider-Man's just he's a worldwide icon at this point, right? He's arguably Superman, Batman, or Spider-Man, which one is the most recognizable superhero in the world. But right. At this point, when we're reading this, he's only 20 years old. Like, as far as the character had only been around 20 years, which just is mind-boggling to think that there was a period of time where Spider-Man hadn't been around forever. But the writers did at least have 20 years of stuff to bank about that, so.
And multiple series and, the cartoon.
Yep.
And he was all over, right? He's a big star. Although, who is this guy dressed in black and white? You
know? Well, before we get to that, I do want to say a couple quick things. First off, thank you for having me on the show again. I sincerely appreciate it. One of the things I love about doing the show with you is it always inspires me to read other comics. So I've been binging a ton of Spider-Man related comics this week, and it's all because this comic inspired me to do that. So I appreciate that. That's the first thing I love about doing the show. The second thing I love about this show is that I don't have to edit it, because folks, what you don't know in between the takes, what gets cut out, I mean, Siskoid swears incredibly in Canadian, like to the point where, you know, Wayne Gretzky would be shocked and horrified at the things that come out of Siskoid's mouth. So I'm glad I don't have to be the one to cut all that stuff out.
Okay.
See, folks, he just cut out 2 minutes of swear words. Oh, my gosh.
I had to. I was so angry.
And then one more thing, folks, another plug. Please keep your comments coming on the website for the Marvel team-up episodes. You guys have been great. You know, I'm setting up this little competition between me and the other FW team-up hosts. And just so you know, Marvel team-up is winning. We have the most comments still. So keep them coming, folks, because we want to show people that we love Marvel team-up the most.
I mean, if that's just goading you into commenting on the other books, then good for them. All right, well, let's get into this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's preface, as we do, with reasons why we like this guest character. You mentioned you read a lot of Spider-Man. It didn't get you to read more Moon Knight?
No, actually, oh. I've have very little exposure to Moon Knight. Where I came to him was, first off, here. This is probably the first place I ever saw him. And, you know, he's had so many versions over the years that the version I'm probably most familiar with is the 1990s version, which okay. is pretty much Batman-esque. I mean, really. He's a little more brutal, but, because he's doing this whole thing where he's atoning for being a mercenary, really. That's it. And I am not familiar with the modern interpretation at all, other than its existence. I mean, I know about it. I know he's got the dissociative personality disorder and all that stuff, but I haven't read any of his solo comics since the 90s. And I've only watched the first two episodes of the show. It didn't really hold my attention. What about you? I mean, do you have a connection with Moon Knight?
I don't have a strong connection with him. I read some Moon Knight, especially the more modern comics in my case.
Okay.
I've seen the show, of course. But what do I like about Moon Knight? I certainly like the look,
mm-hmm.
you know, the moon motif, there's a version where he's, you know, the gold Egyptian stuff on him,
mm-hmm.
the Ankh. And I think I like the connection to Egypt. I like the Egyptian mythology around it, or the invented what, I don't know if Khonshu is real In terms of mythology, but he's like Dr. Fate or like Hawkman, and I like that connection. But I do like the classic costume better. So he's got a very strong look. You know, a lot of people say he's Marvel's Batman, or he was used as Marvel's Batman. But to me, he feels very different. But maybe it's because of the era I read him in.
Well, if you read him in the more recent era, certainly. I just want to comment real quick. I do love the Egyptian mythology stuff. That's awesome. And the this era costume and the 90s costumes are my favorite. Even though I just found this out in my research. Apparently, he was originally supposed to be clad in all silver metal. Mm. Because he was fighting a werewolf. That was part of the shtick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I had no idea. And for me, I think the thing that jumped out at me the most was that Bill Sienkiewicz was so connected with the character. And then in the 90s, he came back for a story. I think it was called Scarlet Redemption, and J.M.D. Mateus wrote it, I believe. That's when I got into Moon Knight, was that era there. So to me, Moon Knight is always associated with like that look from the 90s and Bill Sienkiewicz artwork, which is great. But you mentioned Batman. All right, so I got to talk about this. So the whole idea of a Moon Knight is Marvel's Batman has been around for a long time. And I say it's founded in reality. I really feel that way. Because in the original comics, you know, Mark Spector, he didn't have powers. He just used his wealth to go buy stuff and gadgets and stuff to be a superhero, right? Sounds familiar. He had a best friend who was like a sidekick or a butler. Frenchie, okay, kind of like an Alfred. He's a gazillionaire, right? He uses his riches to get a mansion. He builds an underground base for his operations with all his crime-fighting gear. Okay. He's really into branding. You know, maybe it's not a bat, but it's a moon. Everything's moon-shaped, gadgets and weapons and flying ships and all this stuff. He's got a police commissioner buddy. And then he does the whole disguise thing, which obviously becomes the dissociative. I can't say that word. I'm going to screw it up. But anyway, it becomes the DID later. But initially, it's just a disguise. So he disguises himself as a billionaire socialite. And as this cabbie, very much like the Bruce Wayne identity and the Matches Malone identity. You know, he uses fear, and he fights crime at night, and he's obsessed with vengeance. You know, he's created by Doug Mensch, right, in 1976. Well, by 1983, who's Doug Mensch associated with? What character?
Batman.
Yeah. And then in the 1990s, Chuck Dixon wrote a whole bunch of Moon Knight. And who does Chuck Dixon become associated with?
Batman again.
Yeah. So from a distance, you know, it looks a lot like Marvel's Batman. But then, obviously, they worked very hard to distinguish him, and I would say he's distinctly different now. And it's funny, when you read about his personality disorders that he has nowadays, and if you Google it, like a bunch of people have written articles implying that he's always had it because they've retconned it in the comics to say he's always had it. But it's like, well, no, guys, really, he didn't have that till the early 2000s. The whole first 25 years of his existence, or 30 years of his existence, that wasn't a thing.
You're right. It wasn't part of the character from the beginning. It was separate identities. He just, other interesting Batman connection here, I guess. Kerry Burkett, who wrote this issue, not particularly connected to Moon Knight, did write the, what was it, Batman Adventures? The Batman animated series tie-in comic. That's where I know the writing from, so.
I got a question about Moon Knight's costume, right? So, like, it's all white, yet he's a nighttime fighter guy. Like, now they always...
He's the moon.
Right, I get that. But they always draw him with a bunch of black on him, so he'll, like, maybe he fades into the shadows they're trying to imply. I don't know, like...
I think he's silvery. I think that idea from the beginning that he was silver, and certainly he's got metal boots, metal gauntlets, metal belt. These might be silver. You know, how often did he fight werewolf by night? You know,
right.
Just the beginning there. It's a little bit like when you see the yellow oval.
Yeah.
You know, it's dark, yellow oval. There's a bat there. But at the same time, and I know some artists, especially originally, and then in the new era, they will go with a more like stark white. Like it's a white moon drawn on a white chest, but it's a little like what they do with Batman today, like a black bat on a black chest. You know, it's just texture. It's hard to gauge, but I really like that, the idea that he's sort of reflecting light and shadow. It's like a silver material, or it's like a satin, and there are shades of black in there. I don't know.
Okay.
It's completely, it's comic book physics.
Yeah.
Is what this is.
It totally, yeah, when they do it for the TV series, they make it like a dirty white, but there's no hiding in the shadows in that thing. Right.
Like in some of the new series, and so much in a way in the TV show, they make him look like a mummy.
Yeah.
They'll do the wraps and it's like connect him to Egypt a lot more. And that's an interesting take. It's an interesting look. But nothing beats this classic look.
Yeah.
Which is white, but if he folds the cape down, it's black underneath. You know, that casts a strong shadow.
I love the cowl. Like the face is completely hidden. It's almost like the Spectre maybe or so. Like all you ever see is the white slits of the eyes with the pointy cowl. It just looks great.
Yeah, he's got a great mask. Very simple. A lot like Spider-Man. Yeah, especially in this era where Spider-Man is black and white.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting seeing a black costume and a white costume contrasting each other too.
And his has the blue highlights of Spider-Man instead of the white or I guess the black highlights.
There's like a light blue in there too.
It's how you know that one costume is white and the other costume is black.
Yeah.
We need to talk about the publication history of this character. So I'm gonna start us off, get us through the 90s, and then I'll let you do the era you don't know anything about.
Exactly right. I can't tell you how much research I did on this stupid thing. I probably spent 2 hours trying to figure it out.
Same, you know. So Moon Knight was created by Doug Mensch and artist Don Perlin for Werewolf by Night number 32. That's in August of 1975 as the cover date's role, which I think reveals he was part of Marvel's 70s horror vibe, right? Part werewolf with powers activated by the moon. That's kind of what they're saying. Hmm. Part mummy with the Egyptian stuff. Part Jekyll and Hyde with the multiple personalities. Eventually. Not originally, but eventually. Mm-hmm. In that introductory story, the Fist of Khonshu is hunting the werewolf and he becomes a recurring foil, then an ally of Jack Russell's. Editors Marv Wolfman and Len Wein liked the character, decided to give him a solo story in Marvel Spotlight 28 and 29 the next year, again by Mensch and Perlin. The story, along with Spectacular Spider-Man number 22 and 23 in 1978, recast Moon Knight as a more heroic character. Even briefly joined the Defenders, I didn't even know that, and had backup stories in Hulk Magazine. That's the magazine formerly known as Rampaging Hulk. Bill Sienkiewicz drew some of these and helped define the look, especially the shadowy space inside the cowl. It was much more like a white mask before that. And these would also tell his origin, so, you know, they're important. They've been collected since. Moon Knight received his first ongoing series in 1980 with Doug Mensch and Bill Sienkiewicz as its main creative team. The character received an expanded origin story in issue 1, including Spectre's resurrection in the Tomb of Khonshu, suggested by editor Denny O'Neill. The series would run 38 issues until 1984 and be direct market exclusive as of issue 15. The Hulk backups were reprinted in color in a Moon Knight special edition miniseries. Now, in 1985, Marvel retold the character with a new 6-issue miniseries, Moon Knight by Alan Zelenitz and Chris Warner, and this is where he gets the new Egyptian-themed weaponry and the moon-fueled strength. After that, a couple issues of Marvel fanfare, and he becomes a member of the West Coast Avengers from number 21 to number 41. That's my real introduction to Moon Knight, plus the first 3 annuals of that series. When John Byrne comes in, he writes them out, of course. After a guest spot in Punisher Annual number 2, the character was given a new ongoing title. That's in 1989, Mark Spector Moon Knight, for the first 2 years by, you said it earlier, Chuck Dixon.
Woohoo!
The series ran 60 issues, and he seems to die at the end and is buried by his friends. So that's it for Moon Knight. 4 years later, in 1998, Doug Mensch returns to resurrect him in a 4-issue miniseries. In story, the resurrection is enabled by Khonshu, of course, and I think that's the first real proof that the Egyptian god is real and not a delusion if we go by the mental health problems thing. Mensch then teams up with artist Mark Texeira on a 1999 4-issue miniseries, which was nominated for the Comic Buyer's Guide Fan Award for Favorite Limited Series. But it would be another 7 years before Moon Knight got another shot. And I'll let you pick it up from there.
Well, sure. I mean, just think about that pedigree, though. Don Perlin, Bill Sienkiewicz, Texiera. I mean, such a great pedigree with the character of art. So, and that continues here as we go into it. So as we move into the 2000s, he has a whole slew of various series. So I'm not going to like name check every single one, but I'm going to give you the big picture. So the next ongoing series is in 2006. And it's written by Charlie Houston and Mike Benson with art by, again, exceptional artist David Finch. You know, really fantastic stuff, continuing that trend of amazing artists. And that ran for about 3 years and 30 issues. And then after that, the next ongoing series picks up just a few months after that one. I mean, remember, Marvel at this point in history has a real pattern of run a series, cancel it, and get a new number one. So they tried that. Only that new
They're
one.
Still doing it.
I know. I know. And then they do the legacy numbering. Anyway, that one. Anyway, that one only lasts about 10 issues. Now, around here, around this time, somewhere, and I don't have the exact year, so forgive me, but it's around the 2005-ish time frame. That's when the biggest change to Moon Knight occurred. But it wasn't in the mainstream Marvel universe. It actually happened over in the Ultimate universe. In the Ultimate Spider-Man comic by Brian Michael Bendis, he introduced the ultimate version of Moon Knight. And in those stories, Moon Knight didn't simply adopt new personas for a mission. He had full-blown dissociative identity disorder, DID. And in Bendis' hands, Moon Knight would shift from one personality to another without warning, and his identities would even go to battle against one another. By the way, that was the hardest piece to research in this whole process, was figuring out where it started.
Amazing that it starts with Ultimate. Wow.
I know. Well, the concept just excited everyone. And so they quickly adopted it over in the regular Marvel Universe, or Earth 616, whatever you want to call it. So in 2010, Moon Knight becomes a regular in the Secret Avengers for 21 issues written by Warren Ellis. So you know he's jumping all over that, right? And that's where they introduced that concept of Moon Knight sometimes operating just wearing a simple white business suit with a full white mask. Then in 2011, Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev get a crack at the character themselves in the mainstream universe. They play around with Moon Knight's altered personalities, like basing him around superheroes. Like he has one alter that's Spider-Man, one that's Wolverine, one that's Captain America. That doesn't actually prove to be very popular, which is kind of surprising because it's Bendis. It only lasts 12 issues. Then 2014 is when things really get rolling for him here. So Moon Knight begins this long series of ongoing series. There's multiple ones, and they last all together, though, about 4 years. And in those, the writers really dive into what it means to have the dissociative identity disorder. They really focus on that and explore in depth what it means to have that as a superhero. You get writers like Warren Ellis, Brian Wood, Cullen Bunn, Jeff Lemire, and others. They really redefine Moon Knight's new status quo. And additionally, the writers connect Moon Knight's DID. They connect his DID with the moon god and his benefactor, explaining sometimes his personality shifts to match one of the moon god's four distinct roles and facets. And those are described as Pathfinder, Embracer, Defender, and Watcher of Overnight Travelers. So after 4 years of work that's still pretty well respected, that run ends. Then in 2021, probably to coincide with the TV show, I would imagine, Marvel launched another ongoing series written by Jed MacKay. That series is still going today and will end in just a few months. And of course, relaunches with a new number one immediately afterwards. They've already announced they're doing that.
Okay. There you go. So yeah, Moon Knight is now a property of concern, you know? It's got a TV show, is well received. I mean, the character was well received, well acted. Long life to the Moon Knight, who was B-list at best.
Yeah.
Even though he had all these, you know, some of these series, nobody thinks of Moon Knight as A-list, right?
I was shocked, honestly, to find out how many series he has had. Because, like, again, I remember his series in the 90s by Chuck Dixon. I read that off and on. And I knew he had done other stuff more recently, but I didn't realize he had that many. And I think about that in comparison to, like, when we talked about Monica Rambeau, right? Still, to this day, hasn't had an ongoing series. And I'm like, what's the disconnect here, you know? Because I actually... I consider her, I mean, okay, movies changes things, but I consider her a bigger star than Moon Knight. I mean, she led the Avengers, for goodness sake, for a while there.
But she wasn't a solo player, whereas Moon Knight is. I mean, it's very weird that I first came to him in the West Coast Avengers. I even forgot that. I mean, I read all of that and I forgot them. Oh yeah, Moon Knight was in the team. What a weird choice.
That series was full of a lot of weird choices.
Yeah, it was the weird Avengers, but...
Force works, baby.
Very strange. All right. Well, okay. Marvel Team Up number 144. A cover by Greg LaRocque. Let's talk about this. What we see is the two heroes are more in the background. In the foreground, in a sort of a reddish wash, is the White Dragon, who is the villain of the piece. And he's spitting fire at them.
It says, if you can't stand the heat, don't mess with the White Dragon.
Uh-huh. I think the perspective is definitely wonky.
Yeah.
LaRocque inks himself in such a way that I don't even recognize him. So I think his inking himself is much better than when in the interiors when he's being inked by someone else. The heroes look really great. Lots of great shading on these black and white characters. Mm-hmm. This is where we see the contrast between those colors I was talking about earlier. But the way the fire is going from... you have to imagine that White Dragon is immense and also a very poor shot.
I didn't notice the wonky perspective until you said it, and now I can't unsee it. Yeah, so he's blowing fire somehow behind them. Like, they're in front of the fire. How does the fire wrap around them and go behind them with them in the foreground? I don't get that. And then Dragon's head's probably a little bit too big, but keeping the colors simple helps emphasize on the heroes, which is great. And then I started looking at, okay, wait a minute. How is Spider-Man swinging above Moon Knight, but like his hands in front of Moon Knight's cape? But wait, huh? And but Moon Knight's fist is in front of his leg, and yeah, it's but again, the colors look great. And if you don't think about the perspective, it's a fun cover. You know, they're in peril. I love the stark white background. I mean, there's no background whatsoever. It's just stark white, which makes it pop, right? Which also makes Spider-Man and Moon Knight pop more. And the red. And the red from White Dragon ties in with the logos. It's a nicely put together piece until you think about perspective.
That's the cover. We need to go inside now and do our little synopsis. Why don't we? It's called My Sword I Lay Down. It's written by Kerry Burkett with art by Greg LaRocque and Mike Esposito.
Moon Knight has come to Chinatown for the funeral of Dou Yang, who's the leader of the Tiger Claws Warrior Society. Dou Yang was murdered by the costume villain known as White Dragon, and White Dragon, what he's trying to do is assert his dominance over Chinatown along with his little cronies, the Dragon Lords. So it turns out Moon Knight was a friend of Dou Yang, so he comes to pay his respects and vows to bring Dou Yang's killers to justice. However, Dou Yang's nephew, a guy named Chu Yang, he is furious. He believes that he should be the new leader of the Tiger Claws, and no one's agreeing with that. And he says that they don't need outsiders like Moon Knight meddling in their affairs. So in the days that follow, the White Dragon and his Dragon Lord cronies, they terrorize Chinatown, consolidating their power. The Tiger Claw Warriors Society, they try to stop the Dragon Lords, but unfortunately without a leader, there's really no match for the White Dragons or his minions. So across town, Peter Parker, he's assigned to get photos of the violence in Chinatown. So Peter takes a cab to Chinatown, unaware that his cabbie is in fact Moon Knight in his disguise as Jake Lockley, or as we know nowadays, his other personality. Peter goes to see his old college friend, Philip Chang, hoping that Philip can help him. Philip explains his own personal troubles, which is he grew up in Hong Kong, and he was a member of a criminal organization, and he was pretty far along in that thing, until a rival gang murdered his parents. So Philip vowed never to raise a hand in violence again. Unfortunately, the White Dragon wishes to recruit Philip for his Dragon Lords. Meanwhile, the people of Chinatown are asking him to lead the rival Tiger Claws. So everybody wants poor Philip. So the White Dragon attacks a nearby restaurant, and Spider-Man and Moon Knight break up the party, swinging in there with their blacks and their whites, dodging White Dragon's flaming breath. And then Chu Yang, who's that nephew, again, of Dou Yang, he arrives and tries to stop the superheroes from interfering in Chinatown affairs. And Moon Knight is furious that he could have ended the violence, but Chu Yang stopped him.
Philip Chang comes down in the aftermath and reiterates his vow of nonviolence, which Moon Knight supports, but it confuses Spider-Man. Moon Knight noticed something, though, and heads to his informant, Bertrand Crawley, for confirmation. Days later, Spider-Man catches the Dragon Lords attacking an import store in Chinatown, which seems a distraction from White Dragon bringing Philip to the roof of a nearby edifice, where he addresses the Tiger's Claw Clan to prove they should switch over to his side. To do so, he'll defeat their chosen champion, Philip. And since Phil still refuses to fight, it'll be easy. And when Spidey tries to intervene, Chu Yang, whose uncle was slain at the top of the story, stops him and tells him Chinatown business must be resolved by the people of Chinatown. But when he then races down an alley, Spider-Man follows and sees him conspire with a Dragon Lord. They've put a bomb somewhere on the street, which will take out the Tiger's Claw Clan. Chu Yang has betrayed them because he's always felt his uncle was weak, and he'd rather serve under a warmonger like White Dragon. While Spidey races to find the bomb, using his spider sense as a homing beacon, Moon Knight shows up to reveal that White Dragon was broken out of jail by the Kingpin, the real power behind the Dragon Lords, who wants control over Chinatown. He fights and defeats White Dragon, just as Spider-Man throws the bomb in the harbor. Philip Chang stayed true to himself and didn't fight, preferring to be hurt or killed than committing violence. Only Moon Knight seems to understand.
So I gotta tell you, right out of the gate, White Dragon's costume design, like you can see it on page 4, it's really highlighted there. I love, love, love his costume design. I think it looks fantastic. It kind of reminds me of, I don't know if you ever messed around with a program called Hero Machine where you can design your own superhero costumes.
Sure.
It kind of reminds me of something you'd get out of Hero Machine, but I don't care. I just love it so much.
It's interesting. It's got like the dragon design kind of is inspired by those dragon dances. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, DC also has a white dragon.
Mm. Okay.
I mean, is he supposed to be Peacemaker's dad?
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he was, you know, he showed up in Hawk World and then in the Suicide Squad revival by mm-hmm. John Ostrander. So it's one of John Ostrander's characters. In any case, he's also white and red. And of course, it's more of an armor. And it doesn't look like this. But if you put those two white dragons in a police lineup, I'm not sure I could tell them apart. It's so the same. It feels like it's the same colors. It's the same, although the other one is a racist than this one. Probably Chinese or Chinese American, given the background here. So he first appeared. This is not his first appearance. He first appeared in Amazing Spider-Man 184, 185. So this is his third appearance 6 years later. Philip Chang, who's in this, had been appearing as a supporting cast member since those issues. Mostly in Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, and he appears once more in 1989 after this, and then doesn't show up until 2015.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But he was a Spider-Man supporting cast member in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, you mentioned the costume and everything like that, so and the previous appearances. So apparently this is the debut of a new costume. So okay. Spider-Man says something like, I recognize you in your new costume. Do you recognize me? Or something to that effect. So I don't know if Greg LaRocque got to redesign it. I'm assuming he did. Once you know that, I kind of see some Legionnaire influences with the chest piece. But I'm in love with this costume. I think it looks great. Now, you mentioned presumably what he looks like underneath the cowl. I did wonder. I thought we were going to get some kind of like Scooby-Doo reveal at the end where they're going to pull off the mask and it's going to be some character we knew from the issue. Clearly, I was wrong. But I felt like that's what it was leading towards.
Like it could have been Chu Yang.
Right.
But then Chu Yang is also, you know, running around at the same time. So it can't be him. So, and there weren't any other important Chinatown characters in this. Yeah. So, yeah. No, I agree. It's like kind of a missing piece. But did you go back and you said you read some Spider-Mans. Did you go back to read like his original story and that kind of stuff?
No, I actually jumped forward. And read some 90s Moon Knight stories that Spider-Man was in, and I'll talk about those in a bit, which then led me to reading some Spider-Man comics that Moon Knight's in. So I'm actually doing that still. I'm in the middle of another story.
Because now that he's not, it's not necessarily the same costume or whatever. Maybe he is maskless.
Hmm.
In those other appearances, I don't know. It may not be the mystery that this issue alone seems to say it is.
I assume if he got arrested before, because they said he was arrested. I'm assuming his identity is not really much of a secret if he got arrested.
No.
Although in Marvel, sometimes they do lock people in jail cells in their costumes, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But
you just don't want to look at their ugly mugs.
I guess so.
Sorry, Dr. Doom. Dr. Doom in a jail cell. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, I'm saying. I'm sorry. Sorry I said it.
I have a question for you. Okay. First off, we're told that Du Yang is a man of peace, right?
Okay, yeah.
However, he leads the Tiger Claw Warrior Society, right? Which is their words, not mine. It is a Tong. And it says so in here.
Yes.
And their rivals are the Dragon Lords. So it sounds to me that the Tiger Claw is just another gang, you know?
Yes. Yes. But the Tongs are kind of like the Yakuza in Japan
mm-hmm.
in that they were formed to, I'm going by watching a lot of Hong Kong cinema.
Well, I figured you were the guy to ask. That's why I'm asking.
It's not real knowledge, okay? But I think they were like built around the idea that communities had to police themselves, and it was the criminal element that was doing the policing.
Okay.
So of course, it's like the mafia. You know, it's like we take care of our own. You know, but you got to pay protection. You got to do this. You got to do that. So it was a little like that. So I think New York's Chinatown here, as presented, is its own little island where superheroes don't go. And maybe there's gangs that may be ruling it, you know, taking care of their own business.
Hmm.
I mean, the way they present the Tiger's Claw, maybe, you know, they're not particularly violent. They keep the peace. They don't extort people. I don't know. But it seems like there's a lot of, you know, when you watch like a Bruce Lee movie, like Fist of Fury, mm-hmm. for example, you know, the whole thing with the schools, the fighting schools and breaking the sign and all this stuff. So you've got your martial schools fighting other martial schools.
Mm-hmm.
They're gangs of a sort and they're defending their own honor. But they're not necessarily, like, Bruce Lee's not a bad guy, so he has to defend his school. In that movie's case, it's against Japanese invaders, so it's fine. But, you know, there's a lot of stories like that, where it's one Chinese school against another Chinese school, and they fight, and they're thugs, really, in those stories. And you may have a hero, you may have your Jackie Chan, or your Bruce Lee, or whoever, playing a hero within those schools, and then so you're on the side of that school. But in reality, they're fighting in the streets. They're causing havoc. The police might come in, et cetera, and treat them like criminals. So I think that's what they're kind of going with here.
Okay.
But I agree. They're both gangs.
Right. I mean, gangs don't stay in power by being pacifists. It doesn't work that way. So
no, but if they only fight other gangs and don't fight the citizenry... Yeah, they may be considered peacekeepers.
No, I totally, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, if they're protecting the community only, that makes sense, yeah. Since you're our Hong Kong cinema guy, I'll ask you, like, I think the story was trying to be culturally sensitive, but to you as an outsider with, what, 30, 40 years, I guess now, 40 years later, do you feel like the story's culturally sensitive, or is it culturally offensive?
I don't think it's offensive. I don't think it's necessarily particularly sensitive, but it's not... I don't think it's offensive.
Okay.
As long as you got Philip Chang there as a representative, you know, a friend of Spider-Man's, or at least a friend of Peter Parker's, and there's a community there, and yes, there are gangs, but I mean, across the street, there's the Kingpin's running the show as well. So there's gangs everywhere in 70s Marvel. I mean, it's 70s New York. You know, 80s Marvel, it's 80s New York. There was a lot of criminal element back then, famously so, right? So whether it's the Magia or the Dragon Lords, whatever it is, it's still a criminal element in New York, which we can believe in. And I don't think feels particularly offensive to do that when every ethnic group has their own gang and supervillains and such. I think it works. I would be sensitive to this normally, and I was not at any point given to outrage or even wincing at some sort of portrayal. It's fine.
Good to know, because I enjoyed it, and I'm oblivious, though, so I mean, I enjoyed that.
The small details, do they get it right, you know? Well, maybe not. So, for example, and this is not necessarily insensitivity, but it is, you know, wrong for the culture. Mm-hmm. So if it's the Chinese-American culture, page 7, where we see Philip Chang training, where he's with his shifu there, his master, on the wall are sai, right? That's clearly the same weapons that Raphael of the Mutant Turtles uses.
Or Elektra, yeah.
That's a Japanese weapon.
Oh, yeah.
So the equivalent for China would be butterfly knives. Mm. They also have like a big hilt that you can use to disarm people. Either way, these are weapons for peasants. So symbolically, it works. These are peasant weapons because they can also be used as farming tools. They evolved from farming tools. They were kind of the cheap weapons that you could use against swordsmen who were on horseback that came from the north, from Manchuria, etc. It makes sense thematically that Philip Chang and Chinatown, and you know, that you would have like a more of a peasant revolt kind of feeling to the training, but those weapons are wrong for the country.
Interesting.
It's an example. There are elements that you go, maybe not so much, but generally it looks fine.
I did get a little hung up on Philip Chang's history of where he worked for the Tongs in China. If you read between the lines, it sounds like he was murdering a lot of people and left the country to get away from it. And you're like, oh, look at him. He's, you know, he's a pacifist now. That's great. But you're like, well, really, he just fled China so he didn't get arrested for murder. You know, maybe I shouldn't like this guy that's friends with Peter.
He's on a redemption arc. It's interesting because it mirrors Moon Knight's.
Yes, it does.
And those two are very similar in, you know, it's like, I mean, at least their thoughts are similar at this point in their lives, which is a contrast to Spider-Man. I love that idea that Spider-Man has this friend who has chosen the path of pacifism, even though he has all these martial skills. Any real martial artist will tell you that the true purpose of martial arts is not to fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. The point is that if you need to fight, you can, but it means that because you become a human weapon, then you should not fight and find another course. In his case, he refused to fight, right? So at the end, when Spider-Man is befuddled, like it happens a couple of times, but at the end he's very befuddled by it, and he tries to convince Philip to fight back against the White Dragon, and Philip refuses. It's really, he's telling him, With great martial arts comes great responsibility, dude.
Right.
You need to step up for your community, and you need to fight this guy and prevent this evil from happening, which in this case, you know, as he understands it, would be that the Dragon Lords would take over Chinatown, and they're much more violent and prone to ghastly crimes or something. Giving him the Uncle Ben lesson, and Philip won't listen, and then Moon Knight sides with that. So I find it interesting because I think Philip is just as right as Peter is within their own context. Spider-Man just can't see it. And I really like that our superhero, who's used to fighting people and, you know, punching people, doesn't understand pacifism, whereas you might have many other heroes who believe in pacifism.
Well, and Moon Knight's an interesting example because he believes in the pacifist path, but he's not following it. You know, he is trying to atone for his own crimes by beating up bad people, by stopping yeah. bad people. Whereas he realizes Philip is trying to atone in his own way, and it's different, and supports it. And actually, I think there's even a little bit of jealousy is not probably admiration, I think, for Moon Knight. Sure. Like, he sees admiration towards Philip, whereas Spider-Man just doesn't get it because Spider-Man hasn't walked the dark path. Spider-Man hasn't done so much that he needs to redeem himself, so he doesn't see what's wrong with fighting because he hasn't gone too far.
Agreed. Spider-Man is also a redemption story.
Yeah, from the first adventure. Yeah, true.
Yeah, I mean, it's long-term, but he keeps coming back to it. He's atoning in a way that Batman is not that. Like, Batman is not atoning for, I was a kid and somebody shot my parents. Like, you couldn't have done anything. But Spider-Man allowed his uncle to die, was selfish, didn't use his powers for good, and things went badly. So he's still atoning, and because he still has that traumatic flashback, if we use the DC Heroes name for it, he still has those traumatic flashbacks. He'll keep atoning until there's nothing to atone for, and that will never happen for him. And Moon Knight is atoning, and Philip is atoning. It's just Philip chose a very different path.
Mm-hmm.
And Spider-Man just can't see it. So I like how that's like rooted in character. Philip has made this choice, except he has the power to fight back. They paint him like he could go toe-to-toe with maybe not Shang-Chi, but maybe like White Tiger or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So why isn't he? I like that he's chosen that. I like that Spider-Man doesn't understand that.
Yeah, it's a great way to distinguish between Spider-Man and Moon Knight. And I think the whole package, it hangs together quite well. Because whereas a lot of times it's just they team up and do something. This time it shows you the differences in the characters. And I love, again, the Spider-Man's in the black costume and Moon Knight's in the white costume. It's just you get so many opposites of Moon Knight and Spider-Man that you walk away feeling you know both characters a little better. Which is really nice.
It's pretty early in his career, but I think the issue shows why Gary Burkett was so good at doing the Batman animated universe, because it was done in ones.
And because Moon Knight's Batman.
That too. But, you know, it was done in one. It had to be pithy. It had to be exciting. It had to have a point because it was emulating that cartoon show. And the animated series was like that.
Yep.
You know, like the episodes are strong because they're concise, they mean something, the characters are well portrayed. So he's already showing that he can do that kind of story, I think, in this.
No, agreed.
The elephant-sized spider in the room is what we were mentioning earlier about Spider-Man's spidey sense in this.
Mm-hmm.
Want to talk about that a bit?
you want to say, yeah, if you want to throw it to me, that's fine. So Spider-Man finds a bomb in a store. Like, he's looking, he knows there's a bomb somewhere, and he uses his spider sense to find the bomb. It helps him locate the room it's in. It helps him locate exactly where within the room it is. It essentially becomes a ping, a radar for a bomb.
Later, he senses when exactly it's going to blow
yeah.
to throw it.
Really, it's not danger sense, which is what the power is. Again, role-playing terms, right? It's danger sense. This is precognition.
It's psychic. Can he actually do that? And I'm sure he's done that in the past. And there's probably some other moments where he's done something like this. But it did seem a stretch.
You can do some hand-waving and go, it's fine. But again, it's Marvel team-up. Are they really held to the same rules as Spectacular and Amazing? Probably not. I mean, come on. We're fighting, Basilisk in this thing, you know? And come on. In Stegron.
Anything can happen.
Exactly.
Let's do some notes that are based on, various pages as we go through it quickly. Page one, the splash.
It's great.
Stormy night. It's Moon Knight at the, and I'm going to have some words to say about this later, but it's him at the funeral or going to the funeral. I like this page, first of all. Great swooping cape stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's raining. He's the one narrating. Is he or whatever? It's his perspective anyways. It talks about him mourning. You know, the moaning winds heave in ragged sobs of grief, etc. So it's making like, okay, there's a funeral and the sky is also crying. But the way that the water drips off his mask also seems like he's crying.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's very much like the words and the images are working together as a sort of tone poem about this moment. I like that.
Well, and you talk about the swirling cape. It's not just a swirling cape. It's kind of making a crescent moon. Which is his, which is his symbol, which looks great.
Page five. This is where he's Jake Lockley. He's the cabbie, but he's just a random cabbie if you don't know really the story, right? So eventually you realize it's the same guy that he's Moon Knight. But at this point, he spots, and this is a I guess an art mistake, but he spots the Tigers Clan guys because they wear the symbol. We don't see any symbols. It's all very small figures when we see him in close up. They're with like this John Woo guy with dark glasses there, or a Johnny To, one of these Hong Kong directors. They usually style like that.
Okay.
But none of them have any kind of logo on their shirts, jackets, or anything. So that's...
I'm going to assume they did. Like, we don't actually see their shirts very closely. We see one guy wearing a jean vest, and it's got something on the back. So I'm going to assume that, you know, he got a better perspective than we're seeing in that half a panel. Because you know,
so the logo is on the page before. In the flashback to White Dragon, there's a poster on the wall. It's got a tiger face.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I guess that's a tiger's claw. I would imagine using the claw instead of the face, but yeah. Whatever.
Who knows?
That's not well rendered. Whereas the Dragon Lords all have this big S snake in the back that's very clear. So, but it's interesting how Moon Knight, in several cases, you know, we talk about Spider-Man being kind of psychic in this. Moon Knight is rolling his perception rolls or whatever that would be, rolling critical on all of these. Because he notices that, and later, like, he noticed something that takes him to the path of finding out what the kingpin is behind it all. And he's noticing things very clearly. So that's one of his powers.
Well, I'll say the thing with the cab, he knows to be looking in Chinatown already. So he's been keeping an eye on Chinatown because he's already sworn to take in, you know, to find the White Dragon. So I'll give him a pass on that one. And then the one with the kingpin thing, he actually goes to an informant and the informant gives him the information. We just don't see all the information given to him. At least I feel like that's what's going on there.
Yeah, but he goes based on the idea that he noticed some guy. I mean, good on him. He just, like, he notices things that, you know, progresses the plot. So I'm good with that. They're all very perceptive in this, I suppose.
Spider-Man seems to be in the right place at the right time all the time. It's comics.
You know, that fight in the, in the import store, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you got a guy with a hook hand here. So, you know, you got like a mini boss. It's not just White Dragon.
He's definitely someone you're supposed to recognize. I mean, yeah, because it's like, oh, he's got a claw. So he's bald and he's got like a Captain Hook hand. I'm not going to forget that guy. So when Moon Knight takes him out, you're like, ooh, yay.
And of course, the dragon himself. This is a nice detail on page 9 where he opens his mouth and he spits fire. But it's not a superpower. It's a device within the mask. And we do see the nozzle for that. So that's a cool detail.
And again, that's down to LaRock for doing that. So that's great. Page 11, you do get a silhouette of Moon Knight going after, right square in the middle of the page, going after somebody. It's Chu Yang, actually. But you see his cape, once again, in that crescent moon shape.
The crescent moon. It's kind of, and the next page, it's like crescenting towards the top. I don't even know what the physics are here. And he uses the Batcopter to leave in this particular instance, etc. We talked a lot about all of these sequences with Philip Chang, and so on. I just want to make notice of page 21 towards the end where Spider-Man throws the bomb into the harbor.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a stick figure.
Yeah.
But he's multiple stick figures. They're doing the movement, and you're seeing like several lines. So that's an interesting idea. And it's backgrounded by the moon.
Yeah.
So tonight, there's a giant full moon as well. So it's a great night for Moon Knight.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't think about the full moon part of it. I love it when you see acrobatics and you see multiple after images of the character. Like, you see this with Blue Beetle all the time. You see it with Nightwing all the time. I love seeing the multiple after images of the acrobat doing moves. I just think it looks great. And here, like you said, it's just a stick figure. There's enough of an open center, so you're like, oh, that must be where the spider, the white spider, is on his chest. But the rest of it is it's clean.
Anything else?
Well, I just, page 14 just has one reference that I love. Is I love it when they do this in Marvel Comics, especially at this time, when they tell you, like, Spider-Man will have an internal monologue about what's going on in his life, and like, oh my gosh, I've got all this stuff going on, and it, like, he'll rattle off specific plot points. You're like, that's not from this comic. And of course, they footnote, they say, you know, see current issues of Amazing Spider-Man and Peter Parker. So I just love that they connect those universes together. Like, I remember there was an old West Coast Avengers issue I read early on where the heroes are in LA and they show up and it's snowing and it overpassed. They're like, what is going on? They're like, to find out, see issues of Thor. You know, I love the Marvel Universe connectivity. And this is just a small little throwaway thought balloon, but it makes you feel connected to the bigger scope of, and that's what Marvel wants you to do.
We're into our debates. Who fared better between our two stars? How well first does this fit each of their stories or atmospheres? Is this a Spider-Man story or is it more of a Moon Knight story? Because both characters have some of their supporting cast appear. So whose story is it, Shag?
I feel it's kind of balanced, honestly. Like, if I had to pick one, I'd probably go with Moon Knight because he's avenging the death of a friend. So it feels like it's a little bit more Moon Knight. But I mean, both of them are very relevant here. Like you said, Phillips in here is his friend. Du Chang is Spider-Man's friend. You know, Du Chang is Moon Knight's friend. Both of them, you know, hang around in New York. They're both fighting organized crime all the time. So it feels very balanced. What about you? I mean, did you feel it goes one way or another?
If I had to give an advantage to someone, it would be Spider-Man because I think he's the one that's confronted. His philosophy is confronted by another one. Philip Chang is an actual Spider-Man character, okay. Whereas Do Yang, Moon Knight's friend, that connection is created here. It's not from before. In other words, it's fabricated. For Moon Knight to crash the party. But I agree with you. This is the most balanced team up that we've had.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. Yeah.
In terms of it being like both characters get to do something and mean something, get a lot of page space. I think this is one of the more balanced ones.
Yeah, there's no out of left field, like when Star Fox Spider-Man went to Conan's world or whatever.
What about cool moves? So what is Spider-Man's coolest move? Well, I'll go first. I'll say page 14, since we're already there. He's beating up a bunch of Dragon Lords in a single panel in that jewelry store, jewelry store, and so fast that no one can finish a sentence. So that's a cool, very Spider-Man-y sequence.
I love it. And I voted the same way. It's exactly what I was going to vote for. I spent so much time just studying this panel because if you follow his leaping, you could actually follow it a couple different ways, but I'm counting, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 leaps, 6 bounds in there, and he takes out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 guys. You know, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, from the broken window, bounce, one guy off the wall, off the other wall, hitting a guy. Yeah, there's a lot of...
But it all works. And by the way, I just noticed there's a comic book spinner rack in the corner.
Yeah, I know. I know. Same. The spinner rack in a jewelry store? Well, whatever. Wherever you can find your comics. Yeah. What about Moon Knight's coolest move?
I would say it would be publicly exposing White Dragon's connection to the Kingpin, right? He does it in a very public forum. He embarrasses the White Dragon, and his actions causes everybody in Chinatown to turn on the White Dragon. So I'd say that's a pretty great move.
Probably the better move. Mine is just a cool factor. It's not a useful factor, but he somehow times his finishing move with the explosion. So when the White Dragon gets punched, and it looks like it rips his mask off, it destroys the mask.
Yep.
And at the point of the punch, there's the explosion there in the background. So it's a little bit Greg LaRocque doing this, but let's give it to Moon Knight for an explosive punch.
Oh, it's absolutely, because not only is it the layout, it looks like the explosion occurred at the point of the punch, so it looks like his punch is explosive, and of course, Greg's worked in the crescent moon pattern on the cape as well.
Yes, so there you go. One thing we fail to ask in these things, but I do call it a debate, so if those are Spider-Man's cool moves, and those are Moon Knight's cool moves, who's the winner overall?
Oh, jeez. Okay. Well, if I have to pick my own choices, which was Spider-Man being badass in one panel and Moon Knight resolving the whole story.
It's Moon Knight.
I have to give it to Moon Knight, yeah. But Spider-Man's was funner to look at.
But Moon Knight probably wins this fight. No more weird moves, though. Spider-Man's?
Gosh. So, though we already talked about it. Spider-Man finding the bomb with his precognitive spider sense. It makes no sense.
I'm surprised that Peter would leave the scene to follow Chu Yang while White Dragon is trying to roast his friend like a pig. Because he's in the crowd scene. Oh, Chinatown, Day Sierra Chinatown. Okay, but my actual friend is on a rooftop over there getting choked, getting beat, getting flamed on, you know? I don't think Spider-Man is like, oh, what's he doing? Where's he going down that alley? And then following down a ways, you know, they imply it takes a while. Because it says soon, it's not a long while, but that is a time. It's not like immediately. I don't buy it. I don't think Spider-Man would be that distracted by it.
Well, I mean, to be fair, if Tim Price had you pinned down and was roasting you alive,
all right,
and I had the choice of staying there to interfere or chasing down Martin Gray before he goes off and causes some weird Scottish trouble, I'd probably chase Martin Gray and leave you to your own, figuring, okay, well, you know, I got to do what I got to do, buddy.
So I know who my friends are. So, okay. This is another place where I bleeped a lot of cursing. Now, what about Moon Knight's weird moves?
Okay, so there's a fight where Moon Knight is about to take out White Dragon. But you know he's not going to because it's halfway through the story. But anyway, he ends up getting stalled by just a couple of regular dudes. You know, Chu Yang, basically is who it is. They grab his feet and holds him back, right? So White Dragon gets away. So what does Moon Knight do when he gets up? He doesn't, you know, White Dragon has literally just gone out the door. Moon Knight could have chased him, but he didn't. Instead, he stays there and slaps around Chu Yang and the regular dude's like, why did you stop me? Which is like, okay, I get why it happens for the story, but come on.
Artificial, yeah. I went for a weird story element. I felt like this was a bit of a Bob Haney strip, you know?
Oh, no.
He just happens to be friends with the leader of a Chinese gang who just died so he can be in the story. So it was like, to me, it was real okay. I guess you have Moon Knight going to Chinese funerals. Okay, it just doesn't seem to be necessarily be his world, you know.
Okay.
Although, of course, he's a world traveler and a mercenary, so he can have connections with lots of criminal gangs. It's believable. I just felt like this is one of those things where suddenly, you know, you need Black Canary there. She's Bruce Wayne's secretary. Okay.
Right. I mean, then that's the way comics work. Comic books are always a tremendous series of coincidences, you know?
And this was my weird one. But yeah. I think yours is the better, like, a dumb move. So who's the loser overall is actually the question.
Well, as far as, like, stupid moves, I think Moon Knight was dumb for not chasing the White Dragon. Whereas Spider-Man, I think it was a writing issue, sort of like your Bob Haney. Like, those are writing failures rather than the character failure. So if we're speaking specifically who's the character failure, I'd say it's Moon Knight for not getting up and chasing White Dragon out the door.
But for weirdness at Spider-Man's new psychic powers.
For the writing side of it, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. How about that friendly farewell? Well, friendly, I don't know how friendly this is. Rather than keep arguing with Spider-Man about pacifism, he jumps off the roof. That's the goodbye.
Well, it works for me, because again, we've already talked about the whole thing of Phillips' perspective and Moon Knight's perspective and Spider-Man's, but all three of them have a different perspective. But, you know, Moon Knight's comments fit thematically with his mission, right? To atone for his past mercenary actions. And again, I think he has admiration for Phillip and almost maybe wishes he had the strength of will to be the same sort of pacifist. So yeah, I dug it. I mean, you don't get a friendly farewell, but yeah, as far as farewells go, yeah, I think it works.
It'll have to do. At no point do we really believe that Spider-Man and Moon Knight are like fast friends.
No.
It's not really, you know, like this is a case of a guest star who really lives in his own world, crashing the party, and it's like Spider-Man has no real connection to him.
Yeah, they're just working together.
All right, we'll take a break for a couple of promos, and we'll be back with our special features.
Imagine a podcast that celebrates the things we love. Why spend time being so angry and cynical about our fandoms? Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for a show where we're just trying to be happy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast. Our discussions focus on a variety of geeky subjects that we're passionate about. While the topics will be ever-changing, our focus will be on science fiction, comic books, what it means to be a geek in this world, and other nostalgia-fueled ideas. Life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy. The Once Upon a Geek Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, springing out of Mystery by Night, 16th century soldier Andrew Spector wakes up in the 21st century as a mummy. Now he is the avenging fist of an Egyptian god in I Died on a Moonless Night. the continuing adventures of a corpse who never asked for a second chance at life, only from Amalgam Comics.
All right, we're back, and we're caught in the web. This is the feature where we discuss some of our favorite interactions between Spider-Man and his guest outside of the comic we just featured. So, what do you got, Shag? Spider-Man and Moon Knight.
So
you read a bunch.
I did. So first off, I have an honorable mention, which I think you'll like, which specifically is TSR, Marvel Superheroes Role-Playing Module, After Midnight, which I ran my group through a couple years ago. Now, we didn't play Spider-Man and Moon Knight, but those are the recommended player characters. So they were supposed to be player characters in that story where you're fighting a bunch of the Mafia or Maggio-type characters at war with each other over this mystical book. Anyway, it just makes me happy because we had a great time playing that module. I was inspired to use that module by our buddy Gene Hendricks in his Class 1000 podcast because they went through the same module. Anyway,
okay.
Honorable mention. But what I really picked is from the 90s, my glorious 90s, Mark Spector Moon Knight from 1990, issues 19 through 21. It's a three-issue story written by Chuck Dixon with art by Sal Velluto. And I don't know that it had a name, like an overarching name for the three issues, but the idea was Moon Knight had a young sidekick named Midnight. And Midnight has gone rogue in this story and ends up getting captured by the Secret Society.
The Secret Empire, you mean?
Secret Empire. I'm so sorry. Yes. And in the story, you get Moon Knight teaming up with Spider-Man and Punisher through all three issues. It is deliciously 90s. It is exactly what you expect from one of these team-up comics in the 1990s. I love it. You know, there's the ludicrousness of Punisher's just spraying bullets everywhere, and it only seems to hit the bad guys, which is insane. And in the era we live in, it's a little hard to swallow that with Frank doing that nowadays. Overall, it's a fun story. I enjoyed it. It made me very happy. And that has led me to read what I'm reading right now, which is Amazing Spider-Man 353 through 358, which is a six-issue story called Round Robin, The Sidekick's Revenge. So again, Spider-Man, Moon Knight, and Punisher teaming up, but then you throw in Night Thrasher and Nova and Darkhawk. The sidekicks come back. Anyway, a lot of fun. If you love the 90s, and again, it's Moon Knight kind of in the role of a Batman-type character.
That era. I think this show makes it clear that I'm a big fan of Amalgam Comics. The concept, anyways.
You think so?
I think so. My choice is Infinity Wars or Infinity Warps, Arachnite. At some point in 2018's Infinity Wars, plural, event, Gamora uses the Infinity Stones to fold the universe upon itself, and it creates amalgams of various Marvel characters.
I had no idea about this.
Yeah. So in this reality, Peter Parker's mind was split into several personalities when a combination of Werewolf by Night and the Green Goblin killed his Uncle Ben.
Mm.
So the resulting Arachnite was one of the heroes who got a two-issue miniseries. It's slim, but it's fun. Like some of the better Amalgam comics.
Okay.
I would say. So, you know, it's almost like you're catching the story midstream and it ends kind of on a cliffhanger or things as if this were a series that was ongoing for years.
Well, that's fun.
But it's set in that world. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Werewolf by Night and Green Goblin is a clever combination because, you know, Goblin has been depicted as sort of wild and crazed animal-esque in various, alternate versions.
It's still Peter Parker, but he has, like, the Spider-Man and the Peter Parker who's a scientist and the Peter Parker who's running a business, and they're all compartmentalized as a dissociative disorder.
Interesting.
Our final feature, the bonus team-up, in which each of us proposes a perfect Moon Knight team-up. Shall I go first?
Yes, you should.
Moon Knight and Legion. No, not the Legion of Superheroes, although Legion, the son of Professor X, who had his own weird TV series, much like Moon Knight's. In a way, both have dissociative disorder, and our story would have Moon Knight join Legion in his mindscape, where he becomes all the personalities as separate entities. So you get your Jake Lockley, your Mark Spector, your Steve Grant, your Moon Knight, your Khonshu, they're all in there. They team up with Legion's various personas to fight a telepathic invasion from Amal Farouk that threatens the entire world. So there's your Egyptian connection as well, because Professor X is arch enemy from before the X-Men was also Egyptian.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Okay. Like you, I was originally going to lean into the dissociative disorder, and I was thinking Crazy Jane from Doom Patrol would be a good one. But then it just seemed too obvious, so I went a whole different direction. So I started thinking, all right, Moon Knight, right? At least my Moon Knight, right? Is this knight-themed, all about vengeance, that kind of thing. So what's the opposite? So like opposite of knight and vengeance would be like sun and happiness. So that led me to thinking about, all right, what if the 1990s Moon Knight teamed up with the 1990s The Ray from DC Comics, like Ray Terrell? I mean, completely opposite. Ray Terrell's happy. He's upbeat. You know, he's got the sun-based powers, having to work with his Vengeance moon-themed warrior. And you throw in, like you said, some sort of ancient history thing. So, like, maybe you bring in something like Vandal Savage and say that he had a, you know, part of it was involved in ancient Egypt or something. So maybe Ramatut and Vandal Savage team up and they have to fight him together or something like that. I don't know. But I just thought those would be two interesting characters to see paired up together.
Okay, now it's time for web zingers of our own, which is to say your feedback on our previous episode together, in which we covered Marvel Team-Up number 143, starring Spider-Man and Star Fox. And let's see just how many people you goaded into responding, Shag.
Remember, folks, keep up your feedback on the Marvel Team-Up episodes all about Marvel Team-Up, because we want to be in the lead for the number of comments. Keep it coming.
You're going to make Chris Franklin cry.
Well, it would not be the first time. Remember, he and I battled it out over where the crisis was necessary. Anyway, Matt Sorois commented about Star Fox. He goes, I'm fine with him as an Avenger. He was with the team when I began reading the book on a regular basis. I do like his swashbuckling attitude. It's something that's rare in Marvel heroes, a guy who actually enjoys being a superhero, as opposed to someone who finds it a burden or a responsibility. It's refreshing. You know, Matt, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, I spent a lot of time just with the ick factor of Star Fox last time, but you make a good point. The swashbuckling aspect is pretty fun. And then he says, this was a decent issue of Marvel Team-Up. Sure, it's Spider-Man out of his element, but that was what's fun about Marvel Team-Up. Both the Amazing and Peter Parker titles were there each month to give you the status quo and the latest episode of the life dumps on our hero. But Marvel Team-Up was about giving us the grand adventure and showing us Spidey hanging out with the other heroes, oftentimes introducing us to those heroes. It gave us fun stories that weren't bogged down by what was happening in the main title, and that's why I loved it. Thank you both for another fun episode and great discussion. Well, you're welcome, Matt. We did it just for you.
Chris Pine says, in my opinion, the best runs of MTU are when they have these little two-parters. It gives the book its own kind of continuity apart from the other Spider-Man titles and allows MTU to stand on its own. It also allows for a little more context to get added, some interesting character beats, and makes room for a running joke to pay off, like Spider-Man's What Happened to We, because we don't have to waste too much time setting the plot for half the book, since most of it was covered last issue. I do like Star Fox as written here in this issue, all bluster and swashbuckling bravado. Some characters don't require a deep dive and can still work wonderfully in the right story. And Star Fox, as a one-dimensional character, see what I did there? One-dimensional, they went to another dimension. That's just gold.
Oh, God.
If you do say so yourself, Chris. Well, it works in this one. But those powers are gross. Star Fox does invite conversations that is very relevant about consent, coercion, and misconduct specifically for a good guy. Everyone, we could hope, condemns overt acts of sexual harassment and assault. That's just the lowest bar to clear, and Star Fox doesn't fall quite into that category, although his power could be used as an allegory for drugging victims, which is a whole nother ball to unravel. And there was, in fact, a lot of discussion about consent and lack thereof in the real world and in comics all over the comments section. So if you're interested, it's a very interesting conversation. I will point you to fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Who would have thought Star Fox would have spawned an interesting conversation? Not me. Now from Rob McCarthy, he says, I don't hate the look of the black costume, but I always felt like if you want a simple costume, there's Daredevil. I don't know that I agree with you, Rob. You know, I agree. Daredevil's got a very elegant, simple costume, but I think Spider-Man's is elegant and simple in a different way, and I think they're both worthwhile. But anyway, Rob goes on to say that Shag, the quote, it goes to another dimension, is Marvel's answer to everything. Yes, that is true. Other dimensions are always handy to have. And then he says, since I'm always a negative Nelly, I will say I really like Captain Marvel. I kind of like Marvel's other Captain Marvel too. I'm conflicted because I like Monica better than Billy Batson, but he's the real Captain Marvel. Yeah, if you go down the path of who's the real Captain Marvel, that will drive you to madness eventually. But bottom line, Monica is fantastic, and I'm glad you like her too.
The only true Captain Marvel is the one whose hands can jump out of his arm.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, right.
More than one character can have a simple, elegant costume, right? It's not like, oh, well, we can't have good things because Daredevil has a simple costume. here's Bucky749's pitch for a Star Fox team-up. What happens when the superhero Star Fox finds himself facing a foe greater than any man has ever faced? High schoolers. Can Star Fox and the Ultraverse's Hardcase, Choice, and Prime handle being substitute teachers at Hero High? Dealing with Captain California, Weatherman, and Peter Penguin? Life will never be the same. He's crossing a lot of wires there.
Yeah, he is. He's trying to bait me with Ultraverse, though. I know what he's doing. I see your tricks, Bucky. They were from Brian Schufo, who says, speaking of heroes can manipulate emotions, doesn't Spider-Woman, Jessica Drew, have some kind of power or spider pheromones that attract men?
Yes.
I've only seen it referenced once in the multiple Avengers comics where Spider-Man, Wolverine, and one other male hero are looking uncomfortable around Spider-Woman until she explains what's going on. It was successfully played for comedic effect, though I haven't heard it referenced in any of her recent titles. You know, I haven't actually read any of the Jessica Drew Spider-Woman titles, and she's, I guess since she got them, I haven't read any of those. I love her cool costume that they gave her a while back, but I followed her through Bendis's Avengers, but yeah, I don't know. It is a power you don't hear them talk about that often, isn't it?
Mark Baker writes, as the discussion on Star Fox's powers, their problematic nature, and the question for whether or not Star Fox has conscious control over them reminded me very much of a situation I'm currently reading about in an old 2001 Star Trek New Frontier novel.
Woohoo!
What's up your alley, Shag?
Oh, yeah.
A new crew member of the USS Trident is a member of a species that, by the crew member's account, passively enhances existing feelings within those around him, especially in regard to sexual attraction. The crew member claims that this is not mind control, but that doesn't stop Mares from feeling that her agency was indeed taken from her after a one-night stand. The crew member chafes at being asked to swear an oath of celibacy similar to that previously established in canon for Deltons. As a result, perhaps not unfairly. But all in all, the crew member comes off as a horrible person, especially as he assigns Mares menial duties in apparent retaliation. Apparently, Peter David was writing about these issues even earlier than the 2005 She-Hulk storyline that we discussed.
By the way, as you keep reading, there's going to be repercussions for that, Mark. There's a lot more that goes on with that character. And I'm so glad you're reading New Frontier. It makes me so happy. Then we heard from our buddy Martin Gray, who I chased down the alley instead of saving Siskoid. He says, now, I know I bought this one, but I don't recall it. I've always liked Star Fox's sunny and look and attitude, but that name, he's a fox from the stars? Oh, dear. And even at the start of the Avengers career, he seemed a bit creepy. It's interesting to see how much classic Spider-Man inker Mike Esposito improved Greg Larocque's work, which was, as you pointed out in your excellent show, not always the strongest. Yeah, I mean, we have been critical of Mike Larocque at different points. I know in the Who's Who podcast we have as well. But these Spider-Man comics are pretty strong. You know, in this issue, he's inked again by Mike Esposito. And for the most part, while some panels are just serviceable, I mean, there's none that I think that are really horrible. So it's a decent run.
I think so, too. I think this is one of his better issues to date.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Russ says, I started reading The Avengers just after Star Fox joined. So for me, he is a core member of the team. Same for me. I actually think that the least interesting thing about him is the connection to Thanos. I wish he would get fleshed out beyond that, but there's no chance of it now.
Oh, yeah. No way now.
No.
It's all Thanos all the time. Then we heard from Tim Price, who says, let's see. The issue itself was fine. It was an excuse to give some visibility to the newest Avengers, and it did that job adequately. The story didn't stand out in any other way for me, but that's okay, because I always enjoy Marvel Team-Up as a concept alone, and no regrets buying this issue back in the day. And he says, aw, Star Fox. Since Roger Stern brought him out of the Avengers early in the run, I have a soft spot for him. Plus, with him being a hero in a comic book, I simply trusted he wouldn't use his power inappropriately. That's not what heroes in the 1980s did. Oh, my little brain was not ready for the deconstruction comics on the horizon, but that was honestly my take at the time of the issue. Then he says, I had the pleasure of meeting Dan Slott about 5 years ago at the Dallas Fan Expo. When I said I loved your She-Hulk series, he immediately responded, I shouldn't have written that Star Fox story. So that's interesting, for what it's worth, coming secondhand through me. And then he says, because, you know, we talk endlessly about Spider-Man's black costume, because, I mean, that's really why we're doing this era, is because we love it. And he says, I used to have a silk screen on my wall hanging of Web of Spider-Man number one cover, which was that awesome painted cover, right? And he says, I also love the black costume and wish Spidey would wear it occasionally. Again, I get why, the Venom and all that, but yeah, it's great. It looks so sharp.
Yeah, and there's so many Spider-Man costumes running around. Why not?
Right.
Jason Lady says, by the time I was reading Avengers, the Under Siege story, Star Fox was gone from the team. So to me, he's the guy who shows up in stories having to do with Nebula and Thanos and usually would get knocked out and taken prisoner. So I'm kind of indifferent toward him. He'd also sometimes show up in those call in the reserve members stories. Has he ever done another stint on the Avengers team? If not, he's a done-in-one guy like so many other Avengers, like Moondragon, Ex Nihilo, Silver Claw, Triathlon, Crystal, Circe, Gilgamesh, Nightmask, Rage, Firebird. There's a lot of characters in there that I don't know who they are.
I do.
Okay. Where only one writer wants to use the character. I'd also think that if an Eternal is on your team, they should be mega powerful. I feel like Circe and Gilgamesh were similarly shortchanged. And count me in as another fan of Spider-Man's black costume. It was the costume he was wearing when I first started getting Spidey comics, and I think it looks so cool in some of those gritty noir urban adventures Spidey would get into in the mid-late 80s.
I gotta say, Jason, your comments, first of all, the black costume, awesome. But the Avengers comments just cracked me up. First of all, Silver Claw, that's my total brown jacket Avengers era, you know, totally a forgotten character. Triathlon had the foresight in the comic, I'm not getting this word for word, but he had the foresight in the comic to say, like, I'm the guy no one's going to remember that was on the team. And I'm like, yes, you are, Triathlon. You absolutely are going to be the guy no one remembers was ever a part of the team. So many happy memories. Thank you, Jason.
Well, we're at the end of the mailbag, so thanks for teaming up with me, Shag. You want to tell people what you're working on at the moment?
Sure. You can find me teaming up with lots of people over on other podcasts, such as Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast. We are winding down. We're finishing up breakdowns. We've got to cover several other things before we're done, but by August of 2024, the Justice League International Podcast will be done after 8 years. So it's been a heck of a journey teaming up with someone every month. And then I'm also working on my Once Upon a Geek podcast, where I team up with somebody every month and I talk about whatever I want to talk about. You know, we talked about V. We've talked about, What If. We've talked about Ted Lasso. We're going to be talking about Doctor Who soon. So it's just whatever me and my guests feel passionate about. And then over on the Who's Who podcast, Rob and I have been teaming up again. We're doing the Who's Who review, where we're going back through the classic Who's Who series and hitting lots of characters again. So we sort of re-energized and refreshed the Who's Who feed. So if you haven't listened to that in a while, check it out. We are back at it. And then coming next summer, I'm going to be ramping up my Justice Society Presents coverage over on JSA Presents. Going to be covering the Mike Parabek series, going to be covering the miniseries also from the 90s, and then we're going to dive into the Geoff Johns era of the JSA.
Interesting. A reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content and want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards, and check it out at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw.
Also from Straight Out of the Federation, a Blake 7 podcast.
But he is the next best thing to having Robin Hood as your patron.
Yeah, that's true.
We do enjoy your reading your thoughts, and the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You will read your comments on this issue when Shag is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Chris Franklin as we tackle Brave and the Bold number 195.
And I'll be back in 4 months, folks, for another Marvel team-up. That time, it'll be Spider-Man and Iron Man. Gosh, whatever happened to that guy?
On that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.
Jake, it's Chinatown.